This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
You're listening to Geek Cred, episode number 28. Hey everybody, I'm Steve Rickyberg and welcome to Geek Cred. Geek Cred is the show that brings you behind-the-scenes interviews to give you the inside scoop on everything geek, from tech to sci-fi to games. You can find the main website and find out more over at www.geekcred.net. And if you want to get in contact with me, just email geekcred@geekcred.net. Coming up is an interview with this episode's featured guest, the one and only Leo Laporte. Since we didn't have a trivia question last episode, let's jump right into this episode's trivia question, which was submitted by chatroom regular Zard. In the classic 2001 A Space Odyssey, what does HAL stand for? In the classic 2001 A Space Odyssey, what does HAL stand for? Bonus, what was the name of the computer that superseded HAL in 2010 Odyssey 2? Think you know the answer? Email geekcred@geekcred.net. Here's your chance to prove just how much geek cred you've really got. Or another way to prove your geek cred is to submit your own trivia questions. I'm always on the lookout for more great trivia. Now a word from our sponsor, GoToMyPC. Over recent years, the traditional office has become more of a touchpad than a daily destination. Long gone is the reliance on a landline to work away from the office. More people are performing work from home or other locations, thanks to technologies like GoToMyPC that let you take your office wherever you go. With GoToMyPC, you have freedom from the office, enhanced work-life balance, and increased work flexibility. When choosing a remote access service, you need to make sure it's easy to set up, easy to use, and affordable. That's why you need GoToMyPC, and you can try it free for 30 days. For this special offer, visit gotomypc.com/techpodcasts. That's gotomypc.com/techpodcasts. Take your office wherever you go with GoToMyPC. And thanks to GoToMyPC for sponsoring the show. I am pleased to welcome the Chief Twit himself, the one, the only, the Leo Laporte. How you doing, Leo?
I'm great, Steve. People are going to think you're insulting me by calling me the Chief Twit, you know.
Hey, you gave yourself that title, so.
So let's just say it's okay to be a twit. It stands for This Week in Tech, which is the name of the original podcast. And I guess I thought twit is so funny. Every once in a while, I get an email from somebody in Britain who says, hello, Leo. Love the podcast. You do know what twit means, don't you? I say, yes, I do. It's self-deprecating. I am a twit.
Well, at least you can laugh at yourself. So that's always good in my book.
Hey, if I don't laugh at myself, who will?
Now, you studied Chinese at Yale. How the heck did you go from that to ending up in broadcasting and technology?
No, that means nothing. Anybody who knows Chinese knows that that was complete nonsense, that the Kantian noumenal versus phenomenal theorem is completely misstated. No, I did Chinese until I realized that, in fact, studying Chinese would not qualify me to make a living in any way. Actually, nowadays, it probably would. You know, nowadays, knowing Chinese and knowing something about China would be very useful. But this was 1973 to 1977. Nixon had just opened China. There really wasn't a lot of commerce between U.S. and China. And they certainly weren't lending us as much money as they are now. So it really wasn't that useful. I did it because it was interesting. And you know, my whole higher education career was not based on an attempt to figure out how to make a living, but on what would be fun, what would be interesting. I loved learning for the sake of learning. And then later, you know, I went to the campus radio station and fell in love with it. And that's really what happened. In fact, I went back to my reunion. I never graduated. And I went back to my reunion, my 30th reunion last year. And it was really fun. I saw my old friends. And I told one of my roommates, you know, I feel kind of guilty being here. I never graduated. I kind of, you know, I dropped out to work at the radio station. He said, what are you talking about? He said, that's what people go to college to do, to find out what they love.
It's true.
You found out what you love. You found something that really turned you on. You've made a great career out of it. This is precisely what college is all about. And that made me feel a lot better. Thank you, Rob Weibolt. Of course, he was the son of the Webolt department stores in Chicago, and he's doing quite well. He didn't really he didn't need to worry about it.
So what was your first computer that you really just fell in love with?
The computer thing started for me in 1977, which I was back home in California from college, having dropped out, working in radio in San Jose. Now, San Jose in 1977, that was Silicon Valley, and it was kind of a ferment of it. It was very exciting being there. And so even though in school, when I was in college, you know, I had the guy who ran the station manager, Eric Schwartz, was building a computer, and I was so uninterested at the time. You'd think, oh, I must have been interested in computers in college. No, because a computer to me meant that thing in the basement that you had a reserved time for and you bring your punch cards to. And so, and he was building a computer, you know, probably was a 2K Altair. And we just mocked him. We said, you're such a big fat geek. By the way, he went on to found and run his own hardware company. He did very well. So I guess I was wrong about that. But what got me into computers was, first of all, being in Silicon Valley, and there's this kind of excitement going on. And I got an Atari 2600, which is the Atari game machine. And I really started, you know, I remember when the first video games came out when I was in college, I spent a wasted day playing Pong. I went to the only place you could play these was in a bar. And I went to, they had a Pong table, and I was ordering White Russians and playing Pong all day. And that was my first experience of video games. Loved them even then with that primitive game. When I got the Atari 2600, loved it more, and thought I'd like to do more with this. I want these games to be better. So Atari also made a computer, the Atari 400, that took cartridges and you could play games on. So I got the Atari 400, and played games like Star Raiders, which was a classic Atari game, and I liked that a lot. But this had a keyboard. Not a great keyboard, kind of a membrane keyboard. And you could write software and you could run programs. And I bought a cassette that you could save the programs out to. It would save them out. And I kind of fell in love with it. I said, this is kind of cool. I wrote a program in BASIC. And I said, oh, this is really neat. But I need a real keyboard. So I upgraded the Atari 800. And by then it was all over. It wasn't about gaming anymore. It was about, I really fell in love with computers.
Over to the dark side.
The dark side. That was it. And as I often say, I didn't fall in love with computing until it was personal.
Hmm.
But the minute you could have on your desk a personal computer that you do what you want with, that's now what was long before the internet. So even then, they were just really glorified calculators.
Mm-hmm.
Once the internet happened, by then I was already a professional, you know, covering the stuff and magazines and so forth. But that was 10 years later when the internet happened.
Mm-hmm.
That really changed everything.
Speaking of the internet, what was that like first getting online? Because you were there, you know, in the beginning.
I was there when it all started. Well, I wasn't really, I mean, I'm not an internet pioneer in the sense that somebody who worked at BBN or MIT or Stanford would be. But I do remember the first time I got online. I used a message board service called The Well, which still is around. But it was a really early kind of messaging service. And this was probably 88, 89, something like that. And if you issued a command on the web, normally it would be like kind of threaded messages and, you know, you're kind of in a structured environment, but you could issue a command that would drop down out of the software to the command line. I felt like it felt like going into the basement, right? Lifting up a trap door and saying, what's under here? And I went down in the basement and I didn't know anything about Unix or really much of anything, but I kind of, you know, I typed LYNX. Actually, before I typed that, I typed Gopher, Gopher. And I got a menu structure, the Gopher menu system, which was pre-web. This was how you kind of got around.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd find menu items. And it was really just like a menu tree. It was very, very primitive. But it was still like you could, wow, this is kind of interesting. I didn't know enough about Unix to do any commands. I guess I taught myself some. But then you get on the internet, and it's just kind of interesting. And then you type LYNX, and that was the first internet browser, text only, no graphics.
Hmm.
And it was at the time what it looked like to people who had been using the internet using Gopher was, oh, well, it's just kind of a fancier Gopher where you can have more text on the screen, and then if you want to go to something, you can, you know, tab down or arrow down, and it will highlight a word, and if you hit return, it'll go to that word. It was hyperlinks, but it didn't feel like, oh, this is a revolution. It felt like, oh, this is just kind of like a better Gopher.
Hmm.
But the thing that really does stick with me after I did that, maybe it was back with Gopher and Archie, which was the file transfer thing, was there's a lot of people here. This is a big world.
Hmm.
And all of a sudden, I'm dropping through this hole in the floor at the well, and there's a world out there of people all over the world doing stuff. And that blew my mind. I thought the world is a big place. Now imagine, I mean, this is when there are maybe, I don't know, 100,000, maybe a million, I don't know, people on the internet. Not a lot. Now there's a billion people on the internet.
Yeah, hard to believe.
It's a very different experience.
Yeah.
It was a mind blower for me. It really was.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I could say, oh, I could see the future, man. I can't wait till Google comes out so I can buy stock. It wasn't like that at all. It was just, wow, this is kind of wild. It did feel a little science fiction-y.
I think we all wish we'd known Google so we could buy stock.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't even have enough sense to buy Apple stock back then.
So with all you've done, you're probably the most well-known these days with Twit. How did you discover podcasting and become an early adopter of this medium?
Well, I was a radio guy out of college and did a lot of radio. I was a talk show host. Then I started doing, I was a DJ. Then I started becoming a talk show host. And I started doing technology-focused radio shows pretty early on, like in 1990. I was at Tech TV. We were doing TV. And then I started going back. I left radio for a few years as I did Tech TV. From 98, when I started Tech TV, to 2004, I left radio. But in 2004, I started working in radio again. And a lot had changed in those 6 years. And one of the things that had really changed, I had a website in 1998, but it was pretty primitive. In 2004, I could record my show, edit out the commercials very easily on a computer instead of with a razor blade and tape, and I could put those shows on the website. So I asked, I was working at KFI in Los Angeles, I asked KFI, is it okay if I do that? And they said, I think that they didn't really think it would, they said, yeah, sure, why not? So I was putting out the shows on the internet, but that was just, you know, you'd have to go to the website, and you'd have to click a link, and you'd have to download it, because that's how people did it then. And that was in January 2004 when I first started doing that show. In September 2004, a kid named, and I always give him credit, named Matt Bischoff, he's still around, he was 14 at the time, called me up and said, there's this thing called podcasting. You ought to try it. And I said, what is it? I don't know. I never heard of that. He said, well, you make an RSS feed and then people could get your audio automatically. Now, this was before iTunes. You know, Adam Curry had kind of started there were earlier podcasts, but it's really considered to have started in September 2004.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like right when it was 2 weeks old. And so I kind of went on I went to Wikipedia. I looked at what the spec was and I said, oh, I can do that. So I made an RSS feed. I think I was coding it by hand. I was like literally hand editing the XML of the shows. And whenever a new show came out, I'd open the XML file and I'd add a new show. So that afternoon, after Matt called me, I had a podcast. I just, because I already had the shows on the internet, all I had to do was make the XML file and tell people where to get it. And people were using iPodder, what now it was considered called iPodder Lemon. It was very primitive, Python script. And there weren't a lot of ways to do it, but that was my first podcast, and it was probably one of the first dozen shows ever done. But that wasn't Twit, that was the radio show.
Mm-hmm.
Twit didn't come out until about 6 months later.
So speaking of Twit, it originally started as Revenge of the Screensavers. Could you have imagined it taking off like it did?
No. But, you know, remember, I had already had some success doing the TV show. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, Tech TV was, despite the fact that from the point of view of its owners, it was a horrible flop that cost them hundreds of millions of dollars. From the point of view of we who were doing it, we talked to the viewers, we knew they loved it, we knew it was a success, and you know, it just turned out that the business model wasn't very good. They were spending $50 to $100 million a year to do that.
Yikes.
And you couldn't make that much money out of it, so it was a bad business model, but not a bad business. And we knew it, and we knew there was an audience, we knew something had happened.
Yeah.
So I was already kind of aware of this audience, and what had happened was after I left and I started doing Call for Help in Canada. I kind of stayed in that business, and I was doing the radio show. But I knew, and every time I went anywhere, I would meet some people who would say, oh, we miss the screensavers. We love the screensavers. We love Tech TV. Even in, you know, the first year, in 2004, well, bring it back. What happened? Why? Oh, and people were mad at Comcast for selling it.
Oh, yeah.
For buying it, actually.
I was one of them.
Yeah, Paul Allen sold it to Comcast, losing him in the process a couple $100 million. Comcast bought it and killed it, basically, by merging it with G4 and eventually getting rid of everything. And yeah, people were very, I would meet people who were very angry about it. And so I knew that there was an audience. So what happened with Twit is it was at Macworld Expo, January 2005. Patrick Norton, my old host, co-host from the Screensavers, and Kevin Rose, Roger Chang, Patrick's wife, Sarah, Robert Heron, David Prager, and I all were at a bar, the 21st Amendment Brew Pub in San Francisco. We were talking about it, and I, because I'm on radio, right, I happen to have a microphone. I think I had the idea I was going to go. I do. I remember I went around and interviewed people, which I never used the tape, but I interviewed people at Macworld Expo thinking maybe I'll use this on the radio show, and I had it. So I said, well, and we turned it on, and we just talked, and we did 20 minutes, just gassing, pretty much like Twit is today, just gassing. And then I saved it. I saved it out, and I put it on the. I didn't even do it a podcast. I put it on the website, and 15,000 people downloaded it. And I said, "Whoa,
whoa, indeed!"
I'm already doing a podcast. I really would love to do this, but the problem was, Kevin was in L.A. doing the Screensavers for G4. Patrick was in San Francisco. I was an hour north in Petaluma. Prager was in L.A. I mean, these people were scattered. So there, Roger was in San Francisco. So there was, you know, I just thought, well, I wish there was some way we could do this, but unless we all get together, there's no way we can do it. I'm not going to do a phone conversation. So we just left it there until I finally, you know, about 3 months later in April, realized, hey, wait a minute, Skype sounds pretty good. I think I used Skype on the radio show for, or somebody called, I don't know, I think what happened, somebody called the radio show and said, I'm on Skype. I said, boy, you sound really good. He said, yeah, it's pretty good, isn't it? And then a light went on. I said, wait a minute. If I can use Skype and these guys will sound like they're local, I could probably do a show with these guys if I can get them together once a week on Skype. So we did. And we did. We called it the Revenge of the Screensavers until I got an email, a very nice email from G4 saying, no, you can't call it that. And so we had a contest, actually. I asked people, and it was by our third show. We said, we need a name. We can't call it this. And I gave him an email address, and I said, we'll send a box of Patrick's crap to the first person to come up with a good name for us. Remember that?
Yeah.
And nobody named it. The closest anybody came up with was This Week in Geek, which I liked. And I thought This Week in... And I don't know how it got to This Week in Tech. I think I wanted to really say it's Geek wasn't quite the right... I wanted it to be Tech. And then I thought, oh, This Week in Tech... Because there was This Week in Baseball. I can't claim that I invented it. In fact, This Week in Science was even around on the radio. Kirsten Sanford's show. So I can't claim that I invented This Week In, but This Week in Tech sounded good, and it was a very happy coincidence that it also was Twit.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the self-deprecating feeling of it. I like the acronym. So even though nobody in the emails had come up with Twit, I said then by the next week, oh, we're going to call it Twit. Nobody did win that box of crap. And I finally, a year or two later, Patrick kept saying, when are you going to give away? Sarah wants me to get this box of crap out of here. I finally, a year or two later, sent an email to the people who came closest, and none of them responded. Nobody wanted it. none of them responded.
After all that.
So, after all, and it turns out, if you saw the crap, you wouldn't want it either. And it's only gotten crappier over the years. So it was a lousy prize. Nobody won it. So I wasn't in default, technically. But that's how that came about. So then we called it Twit. And the company Twit, you know, I probably shouldn't call it Twit because it confuses people. Colleen, my assistant, keeps saying, nobody, what's that? There's Twit the program and Twit the company. What's the difference? So I probably should call the company something else, but it's such a well-known brand. It's like Pepsi. Okay, you got 18 different kinds of Pepsi, but you call the company Pepsi, call it PepsiCo.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the best-known brand, so that's what I use for the company name.
Mm-hmm. So you started with that, and you're doing, gosh, how many podcasts now?
Well, it was, we were up to a dozen. It's now 11, two of which I'm not on. So I do 9 podcasts. I do a podcast for every day of the week. No, I do almost 2, plus a Monday through Friday show, The Gizwiz. So so there's 7 podcasts, 8 podcasts. I think maybe it's only 8 podcasts. I don't even know. Actually, it's more because we started doing live video, right, with Twit Live. And that's live.twit.tv. And so I do 2 video-only shows. They haven't yet been released as podcasts. So I don't know. It depends how you count it. Around 10.
Either way, you are one content producing machine.
Well, we could do more. You know, people send me notes all the time saying I'd like to do another, you know, this podcast or that. I could do more. But I don't want to get too many. I don't want to dilute it. So I want people to kind of, when they see it's a Twitch show, they kind of know it's going to be about tech. It's going to have a certain style. I'm going to be on it. It's going to have a certain feeling. And so I really kind of have limited it to it. So the expansion has not been to add new shows, but to do things like video. We also do an audio stream now at twit.am so you can listen. So that's how I've expanded it.
How do you stay sane and avoid burnout? I mean, that's a lot of content to produce.
Because I'm not really working for a living. You know, they always said the difference between play and work is play is you're doing something you want to do. And so this to me is something I wanted to do. I didn't need to do it at all. You know, I was making a pretty good living on the radio show. I don't need to do. I could literally work 6 hours a week and make about the same amount of money I make now. You know, just go home after the radio show, do Saturday and Sunday, and enjoy my life and my kids. But I got bored. So I fill it up. And I fill it up with doing something I like to do, which is talk to people about technology, mm-hmm. like this. I mean, this isn't work. So, well, this isn't talking about technology. This is talking about me, which is even more fun. So, for me, so it doesn't feel like work. It doesn't. It can be exhausting. I actually had to enforce 2 days off a week. I was working every day, and then I finally said, no, I'm gonna take Monday and Friday off and really kind of not even look at the email if I can help it. I haven't been too good at that, but try to just really just be with the family and take some time for myself on Monday and Friday. And that is, you do need to take time off. You need to have leisure, mm-hmm. or just do something different. But the rest of the time I'm doing exactly what I want. I don't work that hard because it's not work.
I guess that's true. I mean, if you enjoy it, it's not working hard. Yeah.
Yeah, do what's fun. You know, and I the schedule isn't that onerous. I come in and we turn on the cameras at 11, start recording podcasts and video. It's all the same thing at 11. And I'm usually done by 4 or 5. And that's 5 days a week. So I'm really only working, 30 hours a week, 25 to 30 hours a week. It's not that hard a work week. Of course, you know, in the morning before I turn on the cameras, I'm doing stuff. After I get off the air, I'm answering email. I mean, a lot of the business has to be done when I'm not on air. So there is more than that. But I'm not working really hard. Mm-hmm. It just seems like I am. I'm efficient. I'm very efficient. And as it's grown, I've been able to hire staff. So I've got Dane, who helps me with all the business stuff and planning. I've got Tony, who's doing all the editing. I've got Colleen, who does all the studio stuff. I've got an office manager, Frederic, who's, you know, keeps the books, answers the mail. So that's really helped. I mean, that's where all the money, by the way, goes. I still don't make any money off Twit, but what it's allowed me to do is get help, and God knows I need help.
And that way, you can focus on just producing content, I guess.
My dream was I told Dane this. I met Dane because he came to do an interview. He came to interview me for a newspaper. The local newspaper. And at the end of the interview, I don't think he knew anything about me, but at the end of the interview, he said, do you need an intern? He was just like really intrigued. And I said, well, I might hire you. And my dream, I told him at the time, was I would like to come in, turn on the microphone, do the shows, and leave. And then handling everything else, editing, posting it on the net, doing the blog, whatever. Somebody else does all that stuff. And that's basically what I've created. And so now it's a very doable lifestyle.
So you've got an audience of countless geeks now. Do you consider yourself a role model? How does this affect how you act, or does it?
Oh, I don't think it changes how I act. I'm very aware of. It's not a responsibility. Well, I guess it's a little bit of a, you know, even from any time, as soon as you become a broadcaster, you kind of become aware of your responsibility to your audience. It starts out by your responsibility to the radio station not to say any of the 7 words the FCC will fine you for. But if you are, if you're good at your job, if you're a good broadcaster, you quickly learn that really your responsibility is to your audience. And you have some, you know, as I've advanced in my career, I've become more and more certain in this knowledge that the only way to be successful as a broadcaster is to serve your audience, to give them what they want, which whether it's entertainment or information, I like to combine the two, and to listen to them. And that's especially true in things like tech journalism, where a lot of tech journalists are focused on the companies they cover. In some ways, it almost is like their constituency is the tech industry. It's like a political reporter whose constituency is the politicians. No, my constituency is the users. So as a tech journalist, it's my job to represent users to tech. So I kind of keep arm's length from the tech companies. I don't want to talk to them. I don't talk to publicists. I don't do vendor interviews. I keep them as far away as I can. And remember that my responsibility is to support users, you know, and so I am aware of that. It's not a burden, but I am very aware of that. And it helps keep me focused. So the issues like ego, you know, I mean, if you're on TV, for some people, it becomes an ego trip. So those issues don't become an issue. I remember when I was studying acting, I think it was actually Stella Adler, the great acting teacher, who said this, who said, your acting has to be informed by a deep belief, not in your character, but in what you're doing. It has to be informed by a philosophy, a commitment, a political, she said, I think political commitment to what you're doing. So Mike, the thing that, and she said, and that keeps you from becoming an egotist, a prima donna, losing your way, becoming focused on how your hair looks or your makeup looks. It keeps you focused on what your job is, which is to serve your audience with entertainment and information and to teach and all that stuff. And so by focusing on that, it's kept me from the pitfalls that a lot of broadcasters fall into. I've started to really enjoy the sound of my voice. I do like it. I think it sounds very good. But I love, you know, I love what, you know, the community that's been created around Twit. And that's what's new, what's different about new media as opposed to the old media is community. You know, if you're a traditional broadcaster, you're kind of, there's a glass wall between you and the audience. In the new medium, in the new media world, boy, you're right there. You're part of it. It's not one to many conversations. It's many to many.
Yeah.
That's hard. That's actually the hardest part, is getting used to the feedback. It's a lot easier to be a broadcaster if you can just ignore what they're saying. But I have constant chatter all the time from the chat rooms and callers and everything. I have constant feedback.
Well, I guess some feedback is better than no feedback.
Yeah, wait till you get it, Steve, and then you tell me. Sometimes it's really hard. And I always warn like people I work with not to pay attention to the chat room and stuff, because sometimes they're very harsh. You know, I'll come in and they say, boy, Leo looks fat today. Or tired or ugly, or you just have to kind of I don't know what. It doesn't bother me anymore. It doesn't bother me anymore. Most of the time I get very nice people saying how much they like me.
So segueing a little bit, what annoys you most? What is your biggest pet peeve about the technology industry?
How little they care about their users. I mean, that's very obvious.
And I
love the tech industry. I hate marketing. I hate PR. I hate advertising. I hate all that crap. I love engineers. I love innovators. I love inventors.
Yeah.
And that's who I talk to. Those are the people I interview. And invariably, their enthusiasm and joy in creating is inspiring and wonderful. And that part of the tech industry, I love. I think we should be very proud of the tech industry in this country or this world or whatever. It's not about this country. It's about humans. This is the peak of human achievement, is the joy in discovery and invention. That's what we're made to do. We're made to be curious monkeys, say, how does this work? And then improve it. That I think that's why humans are here. It's just what we do. And so the tech industry is the most pure illustration of that. I mean, it's amazing. And because it's such a perfect representation, it's so aligned with what humans were built to do, it moves at light speed. It goes faster than any other human endeavor. You know, I mean, it took us how many years to get to the 3-minute mile? It took us how many years to go from a hard drive that could hold 5 megabytes to a hard drive that could hold 5 terabytes?
Yeah.
I mean, it's we're doing, you know, it's like an arrow. Technology is like an arrow because it so closely reflects the human drive to explore, discover, and invent. Mm-hmm. So that part I love. But if you ask me the part of the tech industry I hate, it's all that extra stuff, the marketing and the advertising and the PR and the crap that has to accumulate around it, the business part of it. That's the part I hate. I just the purest expression of the human soul is creation.
Hmm.
And when stuff stays creative, that's great. As soon as it becomes commerce, I lose interest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to have the commerce, I guess, to support it. I don't know. I mean... I'm not against the idea of a trade of, there has to be a flow of the energy, which we call money, that makes this stuff possible, has to flow. There has to be an exchange of energy. But if it becomes about the money, then I hate that. So everything that's about mm-hmm. the money, I hate.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that's about the creativity, I love.
When do you think technology will finally get more mainstream attention from the media, or is geek finally starting to become mainstream?
I don't want it to become mainstream. It is becoming mainstream. And as soon as it does, as with anything, as you know, I grew up in the 60s, flower power, hippie. As soon as the hippies, as soon as housewives in Des Moines were wearing stretch pants with flower power on them, that's when it jumped the shark. That's when I didn't have any interest in it. So as soon as geek becomes mainstream, as soon as I see Rick Sanchez on CNN talking about Twitter or hackers, quote, hackers on TV sitcoms, that's when I go, gag me with a spoon.
Yeah.
That's not it. So, you know, often people frequently say to me, when are you going to be back on TV? Why don't you get a job with the networks? Don't the networks want to, no, I don't want to have anything to do with the networks. The biggest mistake of my life was trying to take tech mainstream. I love the idea of working in the niche, in the very narrow casting. Again, because the people I deal with are the people who have this joy in innovation, creation, discovery. Those are the people I want to hang out with. When I was younger, I always said to myself, I want to hang out with artists. Mm-hmm. I only want to know artists, because I just didn't like anybody who wasn't about whose life wasn't about creating something.
Mm-hmm.
And now I realize it's not everybody's an artist, but the creation can be a computer program, it can be a mouse, it can be, you know, a new way of doing things. It doesn't have to be a painting on the wall. So I do only hang out with artists, creative people who make new things.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Yeah,
I'm very lucky. That's why I'm not burning out.
Hmm.
In fact, whenever I do an interview, whenever I get to do an interview with somebody who's doing something really interesting, I get excited. It's like all over again. I get energized.
Hmm. Yeah. So you are quite the uber geek, to make a huge understatement. But what is one of the geekiest things you've ever done that you would say?
The geekiest thing I've ever done. Well, certainly being the first person on national television to install Linux, I think was pretty geeky. Pretty much anything you ever saw on the screensavers was the geekiest thing I've ever done. I have to say, I've done some very geeky things in terms of asking autographs of people like James Watson, who discovered the double helix and DNA structure.
Mm.
You know, when I meet people like Linus Torvalds and get their autograph, that's pretty geeky. but everything I do is pretty geeky in that sense.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's one thing I could pick that's the geekiest. It's hard. There's so much to choose from.
I think that's really cool, getting autographs. It's like the geek hall of fame, you know?
That's pretty geeky. We used to do a thing which I really loved, and I'm very sad that we've somehow it's lost, is we used to, when somebody was on the screensavers that we really thought the world of, like Douglas Adams or Neil Gaiman or Doug Engelbart.
Real great.
Or James Watson. Yeah. We would have them sign the back of the set, because, you know, every set, there's the front part you see, and behind it is just plywood. And there was a great expanses. If you go behind the set, there were great expanses of plywood, so we would have them sign it. I mean, Neil Gaiman, creator of The Sandman and that great author, drew the Sandman and signed it. Linus, you know, signed it. And all of those signatures, I don't know where they are. They're gone. The set was dismantled and I wasn't there. I begged them to take pictures before they dismantled it. There are some pictures, I think, but that stuff's basically lost.
That's sad.
But that was pretty geeky, getting those people to do that. But boy, that was geek heaven.
For sure.
Somebody said in the chat room that the geekiest thing I ever did was playing a cartoon character on MSNBC's the site. That was pretty geeky. I played a character called Dev Null. In order to do it, I had to wear a special suit of sensors all over my body that was attached to a Silicon Graphics Onyx computer.
Yikes.
And it would generate in real time a cartoon rendition of my body. And then I talked like this. And I had hair that spun around. And Soledad O'Brien, who is now a CNN anchor, would sit at the coffee bar in real time and look at a dot on the wall, which was pretty geeky in and of itself, and ask me questions. And I'd talk about, oh, you won't believe what's going on with Netscape. And that was pretty geeky. Come to think of it, yeah, that wins.
Hmm.
I was like Max Headroom for a later generation.
Well, Leo, there's so much more I could ask you, but I don't want to take up any more of your time. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you. It's great to meet you, Steve. And good luck with geek cred. I hope I've earned a little geek cred.
Oh, you've got tons of geek cred, my friend.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed that interview just as much as I did. Big thanks to Leo for generously donating his time to me. And of course, you can find all of his many podcasts over at twit.tv. That's just about going to bring us to the end of the show, but I live on your feedback. So if you've got any questions, comments, suggestions for future guests, anything, I want to hear it. Email me geekcred@geekcred.net with written text or audio MP3 comments. Or you can head on over to the website over at www.geekcred.net and leave a comment there. GeekCred has a great group of geeks in our little IRC community. Come and hang out with us. Just point your own IRC client to irc.thinstack.net and join the channel Pound Geek Cred, or you can find an Ajax-based web chat over at geekcred.net/chat. Hope to see you there. Remember, it's your donations that help make the show possible, so if you're feeling generous and you've got a few bucks to spare, please consider donating. There are PayPal buttons on the right side of the website, and that would be greatly appreciated. If you're downloading the show manually, please consider subscribing to get the show delivered to you automatically for free so you don't miss a single episode. GeekCred is a proud member of Friends in Tech. To find out more, visit www.friendsintech.com. Well, I've got more great interviews in the works for you guys, but that's it for me for now. So until next time, geek on!
Immortality. Longevity. An endless lifespan. What would you do to become immortal?
My name is McAllen Orsel. I'm a genetic scientist in New York. I'm caught in a secret war between two powerful groups of immortals. I've been told that I am a messiah to a group of people I barely know. I'm forced on a quest around the globe to fulfill a destiny I never chose. If only I can stay alive.
From Krzysztof Lipotka comes The Leviathan Chronicles, an audio adventure like you've never heard before.
What is Leviathan?
We have been among you for almost a millennia.
What? Immortal?
They can't know about Leviathan.
Blow those charges.
No!
Get down!
Why have you brought me here?
You are here because we need your help.
She was never trained for this.
She was bred for it, Anton.
Well, she doesn't know that.
You'll need to find me, McAllen.
To discover the Leviathan Chronicles and get the next dimension in podcasting, go to www.leviathanchronicles.com.